Hello and welcome to the Leadership and Insurance Podcast. This is the podcast that brings you the latest in insurance leadership stories, whether they be from the insurtech world or whether they be from the innovation coming out of the incumbent market. We're looking to people that change the shape of the insurance world as we know it in 2021 and beyond. In this episode, I was lucky enough to be joined by Amrit from Hyper Exponential. Amrit's a fantastic guy. He was referred to me by a couple of people, and I think we connected via his involvement in the Lloyd's Lab. He also runs a fantastic podcast called Startup Dads. Startup Dads is a podcast about the challenges of starting new businesses and starting a family and the parallels and joys that come out of both of those things. It's a really good listen. I listened to a couple over the weekend and really enjoyed it, so I recommend that strongly. But his role at Hyper Exponential, he's a former actuary from the market. And him and one of his colleagues who are both actuaries and computer scientists, because they weren't satisfied by doing one hard thing, started a business called Hyper Exponential, which is a next generation analytics platform for actuaries and other related insurance individuals to build models within. It's a really interesting concept, really interesting business, and it's got some great traction out there. This is a good pod, a really good pod, and I enjoyed doing it. We had a few technical difficulties at the front end, so the sound's not as good as it should be, but that's entirely my fault. But I really enjoyed this, and I think you will too. So this is Amrit from Hyper Exponential.
Good morning, and welcome to the Leadership Insurance Podcast. We're in 2021, very lucky to be joined by Amrit of Hyper Exponential. We've had some massive tech difficulties on my side, so I'm going to apologise. Amrit has already been through some motion sickness while I adjust the camera, which is playing off my phone. So if there's any recording issues, I'm going to blame the technology and not the fact that I'm incredibly adept at doing it. But with that massive caveat aside, good morning, Amrit, and how are you?
Hi, Alex. I'm really well, thanks. Thanks for having me on the podcast.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for sitting through the tech setup. But Hyper Exponential, so couple of actuaries really interested in data science, go off and this is the sort of business you come up with, right? So I wondered if you'd be kind enough to kind of walk us through Hyper Exponential, what you guys do and the purpose of the business.
Sure thing. So at our core, what HX does is we're building a platform to help insurers, mainly in the specialty place at the moment, make better data-driven decisions. Right. So Michael and I, my co-founder and I, we've been in the industry, the specialty insurance industry, for more than 15 years now, spent a lot of time in that industry working as pricing actuaries. So helping underwriters, insurance companies use data to calculate prices. Mm-hmm. I think the phrase pricing in insurance is particularly in the specialty sector, is a little bit of a misnomer. You know, it's not like car insurance where, you know, there's a really well-known price because there's tons of data. To perform analysis on, you know, the claims and the world of kind of cars driving around and crashing. So, you know, there's no perfect price. And the second thing is actually often the case is that people want to do much more than just come up with a number when they do pricing. So, you know, we don't call ourselves a pricing company. It's data driven decision making. We build a SaaS platform. It's called Renew. Used by very large and very small insurers to support them in their data-driven decision-making. And we've been doing that for about 3 years now.
Yeah. So I love that. There's got a few bits and pieces in there that I want to unpack. I want to start with that thing on the specialty lines. You know, it almost sounds to me that you're leaving a bit of room for creativity. You know, pricing is not just, it's not all science, it's all not all numbers. There's a bit of creative thinking goes into it, which what makes it different. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, definitely. It's a really, it's definitely, you should help us with our marketing, because that's a much cooler way of saying it than I would. But I think it's absolutely the case that, you know, when you don't have a lot of data or your data is, you know, we call it small, sparse and fragmented, rather than massive reams of data that you do in some of the more personal conventional lines of insurance. There's a lot more judgment. There's a lot more creativity. There's a lot more, lot fewer rules that we'd use, right, to come up with the price. And I think one of the things that we try to do at HX is to build a platform that helps our users, who are predominantly underwriters, actuaries and underwriters, take their data and make better use of it. And so creativity is definitely a very nice word for it. You know, flexibility is a key thing, I think we would say. You know, making sure that you can take advantage of all the data that sits around us today. You know, even in the specialty sector, you know, there's not as much data, but it's increasing every single day, the volumes of data. And to use, you know, creative, clever ways of analysing it as well. You know, I always used to joke with my analysts, who, when I worked as an actuary in the markets, that I was broadly teaching them the same things that I'd been learned 15 years ago. Well, that's sad, really. You know, the global specialty industry is $220 billion. There's definitely room for a lot more and better and more creative. I'm going to use that now, use of the data.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's the creativity. I mean, I think that's when you look at it from a kind of science perspective, don't you? I mean, that good science is, you know, applying what you know and then making kind of leaps of faith or leaps of creativity to kind of come up with the next best answer. And I think there's always this view of science that it's not creative, but it's you know, it's one of the most creative kind of things you can look at. And maths is just a language to explain, you know, the thing most concisely. So, yeah, I think there's an obvious kind of room for creativity in pricing when there's the gap in knowledge. I like the fact that you guys didn't cheat either, because there's a lot of actuaries that have just rebranded themselves as data scientists without really applying any new skills. But you went back to school and did some computer science, or is that computer science you've been there?
Yeah, so actually before I was an actuary, I studied software engineering computer science at university. It's a good point about the cheating thing. I think it's very easy for the actuaries who've studied software engineering to dine out on this a little bit and call themselves data scientists. So we started, you know, Michael and I, and HX is kind of core. We're an engineering firm. We were computer scientists before we were actuaries. Definitely, right. I mean, I studied computer science around the time of the dot-com kind of bubble bursting. So at the time, you know, I thought like a total fool when I graduated that it was a bad idea to become a software engineer, which is definitely absolutely wrong. My first prediction, one of many predictions as an actuary I've made that was wrong. Certainly got that very strong software engineering background, and we've applied throughout our whole careers, which I think was probably how we ended up setting up HX. Because, you know, I think there is definitely a blurring of boundaries between data scientists and actuaries, definitely more so the actuaries wanting to be the data scientists and the data scientists want to be the actuaries. But it's absolutely been an incredibly useful skill to have, you know, a very strong technological foundations. Part of what HX is trying to do is to make it easier, actually, for actuaries and technical people in insurance companies to use those technical skills. You know, we're trying to democratize some of those technical skills. Huge amounts of open source, high quality, freely available, well community supported, easy to learn, deeply powerful technology out there that, you know, a bunch of smart cookies like actuaries tend to be can use. And then they won't be cheating so much, maybe.
No, that's very true. I know that there's a question that I'm just going to leap ahead to that I had written down, which is like, you know, how important is that kind of open source thinking to kind of pushing the boundaries and the evolution of insurtech and the insurance market? Because, you know, it points to what we were talking about just now, in the gap in knowledge is provided by you don't have enough information, and open source is by definition kind of the sharing of knowledge. Seems to me that that's key to kind of really taking insurance to where we want to go.
Yeah, I think that's a really good insight, one that's not talked about a lot. I mean, I'm a little bit biased here because Renew is a platform that exposes large amounts of open source technology. I think it's critical. I think it's actually going to be the only way in the long term that insurance can keep pace with the incredible technological kind of boom that we're seeing across all industries in the world at the moment. Enterprise technology has historically been incredibly proprietary. You know, that's not just in our sector. I mean, you know, our competitors and most of the people in the space that we play in sell very proprietary solutions. And I'm not going to pretend that Renew is an open source, completely open source product, right? It's not. Enterprise technology has historically been very proprietary. And as soon as you set up technology that, you know, I always used to joke that kind of 15 people in the world know about, you know, it can be really great for the companies who sell that software if they get a good base of users. But it can be really hard for the actual clients who want to, you know, in this day and age, we Google our way to many solutions. Mm. Yeah, you want, if you have a problem in your life, right? I had a child recently, you know, I spent my way trying to Google my way to many of the solutions for that, right? Watching YouTube videos on how to change nappies at the beginning, you know, but we're a generation now that try to use the internet and use the kind of the vastly sea of knowledge out there to help ourselves. It's very hard to do that with proprietary tech. And that was one of our big motivations for making sure that, you know, if you want to, sorry to be boring for a moment, you want to do a VLOOKUP in our system, the equivalent of a lookup table in Excel, is that you can go Google your way to do that. You don't need to pay someone, you know, £250 an hour to tell you how to do it. Mm. And I think, you know, if you look at most of the big the sectors that leverage technology right at the cutting edge, you know, the ones that are well known, banking, retail, you know, huge amounts of open source technology, huge amounts of open source technology that's been created by the likes of, you know, JP Morgan and other companies like that, that they then push back into the community. So yeah, I think we've got a long way to go. We're doing, trying to do our little bit. Mm-hmm. I think you can expect to see HX making contributions towards the open source community directly over the next year and beyond. We think that's, it's absolutely critical.
Yeah, no, I agree. And yeah, it's not something that, you know, when I started down this journey of podcasting, and I know you're a fellow podcaster, and I'm gonna ask you a question about that in a bit. I think it's just the best thing about talking to people is that it's much easier for me to understand trends. You know, it's that classic thing of, it's much easier to ask someone a question than almost counter to what we've just been saying. In a way, if you want to understand something, it's much nicer to get someone who's an expert and ask some questions than try and Google and put it all together yourself. But I think you're right. If there's a specific piece of knowledge you're lacking, then you can Google your way to it. To the point where I'm not even worried about dementia anymore. As long as Google doesn't forget, I'll be fine. But I mean, I joke because I don't know about you, but I've realized that I don't remember anything now. And I know there's some evidence out there to say that people's brains have changed in the way that we hold information. We don't hold the information anymore, but we hold the way to get to it, which sadly has one answer, which is Google it.
indeed. You can see why they're one of the most valuable companies in the world. And I think, you know, that's a very broad sweeping, much bigger challenge in insurance, the way technology has changed the way, you know, what's useful to have as skills, you know, in the world now. You know, rote learning and memorization were a critical part, even in, you know, you don't need to go that far, you know, 5 to 10 years ago, having those skills at your fingertips without needing to look them up. You know, even as an actuary, there were certain things that if you knew off the top of your head, they were really useful. That's changed now. And, you know, that motivates lots of things, you know, in the design of solutions, whether they be technological or otherwise, to help people, you know, in business, right? You need to think a little bit about what they need and what they don't. And, you know, an example for us in that would be, you know, building really good documentation. Mm. You know, I feel like I almost don't want to talk about it because it's the sort of thing that's a comparative advantage for us. However, you know, we obsess about documentation, right? Because simple fact is people don't need to memorize stuff now. They can go look it up quickly and you can make it easy for them to do those sorts of things. Then they can be productive and happy and get on with their day jobs.
Mm. Mm, no, that's so right. And do you think it's well that I think the way that people are judging their kind of software choices or even tech and service choices is on how, it's more about how it interrelates with other software and other services. So, you know, I've just been through the process of choosing a new CRM system for me as a recruiter. But when I started in recruitment, CRM system was really an advanced filing cabinet, but it was your competitive advantage because you didn't have, this is how old I am, you didn't have LinkedIn, it didn't exist. So other than these kind of job boards where you could advertise and harvest kind of CVs, etc., you because didn't have GDPR either, so that was so you could hold that in forever. But you didn't have these kind of services and other platforms, but now you do. My whole question mark is how easily, how quickly do they interrelate with all these other bits of, and it's not just LinkedIn, it's, you know, things related to my phone system, it's related to other bits of communication. it's essential that they all work seamlessly. And that's actually the sole way I judge them. I'm not really interested in, because the stuff that's like, oh, is it a very good repository for holding and sorting through information? I take that as a given. What's the challenge is how well does it relate to the other technology?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think this is a really fascinating a challenge or dichotomy that we're seeing played out in the broader technology world, but in insurance as well. You know, I think the idea of a monolith, a single system that deals with everything versus best of breed and an ecosystem. I mean, you look at Lloyd's and the Blueprint 2 and the Future at Lloyd's strategy, which is pushing the ecosystem of technology really heavily. It's not just kind of individual companies that are operating this way. It's the whole market. So yeah, I think, you know, this is probably almost old news now, but we've been seeing a shift in the last, you know, 5 years or so away from these big monolithic systems where you can buy, you know, something that's just about good enough at everything to things that are really, really great at individual, solving individual problems. And, you know, everyone has a slightly different configuration of challenges and problems that they see as important. And the best of breed system allows you to assemble those components in proportion to your own needs. Mm-hmm. I, you know, despite being obviously a huge believer and promoter of the best of breed solution, I think one of the things, challenges we see in with our clients is data engineering and architecting all of these bits, plugging them together. It's a skill. It's a skill and it's a kind of, it's almost a team by itself. Mm. We often see people adopting a best of breed landscape. Not necessarily our clients, because our clients tend to, you know, as an early stage business, we tend to get engaged with clients who are a little bit more progressive and think about this stuff a bit more. But we see a slightly more traditional insurers trying to move towards a modern ecosystem approach without having the resource available to how they configure and assemble that ecosystem. Yeah. So yeah, it's a really interesting challenge. I think I don't see us moving towards, I mean, again, I would say this, but I don't see us moving towards the monolithic systems of old. I don't know many people who use big old monoliths in their systems that are particularly happy.
No, I think that's it. I think the only people still sort of stuck with them is the challenge of getting away from that. You know, but that in itself answers the question about whether they're a good idea, because if it's a challenge to get out of that, you know, we live in a world where you should be interchangeably, you know, that's one of my hates against Apple. You know, like if you can't get out of that ecosystem, then that's a bad business. You know, it's good business for them. It's bad business for me. Is what I want to say. So the business is about 3 years old. You are both successful guys. Oh, the classic of using the phone to record. It's really it's because I'm so busy. What I wanted to ask you is that why 3 years ago? Why was that the time? Or was it that, you know, HX became a real idea and therefore the idea came, or was it just we want to do something and this is the time to do it?
Really good question. So I always like the phrase, you know, the best time was 20 years ago, the second best time is now. Yeah. Right. So I would say a couple of things. HX has been I've had the idea for a system, you know, for 10 years or so, because right. I'm mainly motivated by the fact that everything I've seen in the market just wasn't designed for the needs and requirements of our clients, but me when I was back in the day. Yeah. So what motivated me back then was actually 10 years ago, I always suspected that this was true, but 10 years ago I was more junior working on the front line as an actuary. And I thought, you know what? I just haven't found the right piece of technology yet. 3 or 4 years ago, I ended up being the head of pricing, Tokio Marine Kill, one of the largest managing agents at Lloyd's, clean slate, management buy-in, all the ingredients required to test the hypothesis. Actually, is it true that there is no technology out there that meets our needs? And I actually made the assumption, actually, that, you know, I just haven't found it yet. At TMK, spent a lot of time trying the solutions on the market, trying experiments, building it ourselves. And basically, I realized that this was being a massively neglected sector in the market. So, you know, and as soon as I had that, I actually had that very cheesy eureka moment. I was kind of like, someone's got to do something about this. And yeah. I was like, oh, hold on.
It's me.
You know, software engineering, actuarial, you know, been in the market, head of pricing, understand it. You know, don't get me wrong, still really difficult. Massively naive as to how, you know, what I thought I was taking on versus what I actually was taking on. But yeah, so to answer your question, I assumed that we wouldn't be needed for 7 years. And then actually realized very quickly that we would be needed. And, you know, we have a way of doing things that's not the same as our competitors. They have a way of doing things. People buy their software, people buy our software. But I really firmly believe that, you know, the way we're going about our business is going to be the right solution in the long term. So it wasn't difficult, actually, at the time.
No. Did you, because you've just had, you mentioned you just had a child, because that's what your podcast is about, is being a founder and a father, a new father.
Yes.
So just the one, or?
Just the one, sorry. Yeah, so you can see the life of a founder. I'm currently working in my kitchen with my gym gear on one side and my baby's toys on the other. Yeah, so I had my first child, Evie, a year ago. She's 13 months now.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, so that was fun. You know, I think when I set up HX, it felt like my first child in a very different way, right? Yeah. And then obviously having Evie now, I have two children. One's much more important. Evie is much more important. Yeah. Although they're both very important and both very big parts of my life. And it's been a really, you can probably hear her now on cue, she's starting to smash things. Sorry about that. you know, it was actually really interesting to think about the learnings and challenges that I've had of setting up a business with the learnings and challenges of having a child. You know, they're both things that you think you can, you have an idea of what you think you're going to do, and then it comes along and it's completely different. And you realize that there's no rule book, no right way or wrong way, and they're incredibly important and you're responsible for them. So that's what motivated me to set up my podcast. Yeah, it's called Startup Dads. Yeah, the highs and lows of running a business and growing a family at the same time.
That's what it's yeah, about. I mean, I think that's because I think that question is really interesting for everyone. It's always about, you know, why now? Because I think, you know, I mentioned to you that my favorite thing at the moment is that they say everyone's got one good book in them. Everyone in insurance seems to currently think they've got one good insurtech in them. and that may or may not be true, but the big challenge is that insurance, you know, if you're senior in insurance, it's a well-paid industry. It's a good lifestyle. It's good fun. There's good people in the industry. And you're not leaving that industry if you're going to go and start an insurtech, but going from that kind of very cozy lifestyle, you know, great buildings to work in, to the gyms, to setting up in the kitchen between your gym equipment and your, you know, the baby stuff is a very different leap. And, you know, timing is kind of everything, I think, for that.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And I think, you know, it's a really interesting one. I feel really grateful for the 15 years I had in the market. You know, I'm a huge fan of what the insurance markets do. I think, you know, they're an undervalued aspect of the financial sector. And the industry is working hard to try and change that. We've got a long way to go, but we are working very hard to change that. It's definitely timing is everything. And you don't get me wrong, you know, I earn the British minimum wage now compared to the head of pricing salary that I used to a few years ago. But I think the reality of the situation is when you're a founder, if you have an idea, I really like there's a really good talk online by a guy called Dustin Muscovitz. He's the founder of Asana. I don't know if you know the project management productivity suite, Asana. Yeah. He's ex-Facebook. His share of Facebook turned out to make him a billionaire by himself. And he founded Asana. And he talks about, you set up a startup, you know, the only right reason to set up a startup is because you have to do it. Not because you want the fame, the glory, the money, because there's none of that. There's no fame, glory, or money for several years. Right? HX is doing absolutely great, and I'm pretty sure that I don't have much of any of those things. But what I do have is a really great opportunity to build a really great business that I feel like I have to do. And, you know, the biggest thing for me is my biggest motivation now that HX is past, you know, touch with the kind of early stage infant mortality phase of a business without wanting to jinx it, is my motivation is to make the business and our contributions to our clients and the market as big as and as impactful and as useful as they can be. Mm. And I think, you know, if your motivation is anything but to actually make the business great, it can be a really miserable slog running a business, because none of those other bits come for quite a while.
I remember that. I've worked for myself, and at one point I had a team, but I remember the that moment. I did one of my most senior placements ever, big global role. First time I'd done anything of that scale working for myself. I'd always done it working for, and then I filled it, and the person accepted and resigned and looked up. And I kind of wanted that bell ringing moment, because that's what we do, that shit, someone to high five. And I was just on my own in the office I'd rented. I was like, oh, just better keep going then, you know.
Get back at it. Next one. Yeah, exactly. Exactly that.
Yeah, and there's not the glory you think there might be. You just have to get some intrinsic value out of it, I think, and you have to really want it, because you're making your life harder. Like, that's fundamentally what you're doing. And yeah, there might be future gains and goals, but I think if you're doing it, I would say to people, if you're doing it just for money, there's easier ways to do it. You know,
definitely.
Go back to insurance and you know, get that promotion, and then probably do that.
Absolutely. I mean, the reality of running your own business, as you know, right, is that, you know, if you want the most likely path to a lot of money, then putting 2/3 of the effort that you have to do into your own business, into your career, is easily the most likely way to get the success that you want. But if your motivation is, you know, the fun and the finding great teammates or partners or people you work with, building something great, then there's nothing like it. And the same thing applies to family life, I think.
Yeah, I totally agree. So you obviously start with the co-founder. I noticed online that you have the CEO title, and they are sort of chief product officer or head of
product. Michael's the chief product officer, yeah.
Yeah. How do you make that decision on who takes which role? And you know.
It was really easy. So I suppose Michael's my co-founder. He's my longtime friend. You know, we've worked together, and we often joke that what would we do without HX? Well, probably whiskey, cricket, gigs, all the stuff that we actually used to do because we're mates. So I suppose it's one of those things that Michael and I have known each other for 10 years. It's the sort of thing that you don't build a friendship and relationship like that overnight. And, you know, Michael is the critical cog in the HX machine that no one knows about or sees, because he just keeps his head down and helps us build a really brilliant product. So Michael, if you listen to this, make sure you're grateful for the plug I'm giving you. You know, how do we choose responsibilities? I mean, we know each other very well. We know our strengths and weaknesses. That was really, really easy. You know, the CEO and CPO titles, they're titles. You're a co-founder in the business. Your job is to do whatever is needed, to keep the business going. So, you know, I always remember on our, I'm sorry, I'm going an amorate way of answering your question, but I will get there at the end. But I remember closing our seed round and then taking out the bins in the evening. So, you know, as co-founders, you do whatever is needed. Michael's strengths are very, very clearly on the product development side of things. And my strengths are a little bit more on the application, the business side of things. So really, really easy. It was the sort of thing that didn't really need a discussion, actually. I don't think all businesses who start, particularly if you don't have a natural co-founder before, it's as easy. For us, you know, we knew our strengths and weaknesses. We recently did this, the Belbin test. You're familiar with these personality tests that you use And, you know, Michael and I, you can put us just on opposite. They break it down into quadrants. And Michael and I are just on two completely opposite parts of the circle. So it was, yeah, sorry. So that's a bit of a cop-out answer. It was really easy. We didn't really have to draw straws. We no. both do the bits that we love doing. And the reality of the situation is, as a co-founder, that I do bits of Michael's job sometimes. Michael does bits of my job sometimes. And we also do bits of the jobs that are nothing to do with the CEO or CPO title on a very regular basis, because we're a small, fast-growing business, and you do what's needed to do.
No, it's not a cop-out answer. I think it's generally the answer. I think where there's challenges is where it's a bit like those boy bands that get put together, manufactured artificially. Like, that's where you see ruptures. I think if you've worked together before, I think there is a natural kind of fit into stuff. It's a bit different in my world, because you've got a bunch of salespeople in a room going, who should be CEO? And they all think they should be. Funnily enough, I know it shouldn't be me, because I did a personality test which was about leadership. And I have to quote that, I have less than average leadership potential.
Well, the good news, Alex, is that you are the at the top, the bottom, and the average in your team, right?
If you were exactly. That's the beauty of it. So that always cracks me up. I was there on a course about how to learn how to administer and analyze these personality tests for leadership. So I did this, and we had to do one on ourselves, and I was like, that's the most depressing thing. I wouldn't mind, but I paid about $2,000 to be there.
I mean, the only thing I'd say to that, and maybe it's only slightly related, is that leadership is it's a funny word, right? And there are so many things involved in making a business very successful. And I think one of these things that people don't realize, and I didn't realize this at the beginning, right, is that building a really great product, or leading a team to build a really great product is a tiny part of what it takes to make a successful business. Leadership is really important, and it's a critical factor. Don't get me wrong. It's probably the most important factor in an executive's job, right? Of a startup or established business. But there are lots and lots of other bits, you know, that are required to make the business work. It reminds me of, you know, an underwriter. He's the CEO of a company now. Told me that, you know, he's an underwriter himself. He said underwriters in insurance think that often tend to think that, you know, underwriting is the only thing you need to make an insurance company. This is an underwriter saying this to me. I don't believe this, right? Of course. And he said, but the reality of the situation is, right, that you don't have an insurance company without underwriting, but you also don't have an insurance company without all the other functions. And it's the same thing applies, I think, to principles of, you know, leadership means lots of things.
I'm always reminded of there's a economic historian called Rutger Bregman, I think. He's the guy that spoke at Davos and told them he made headlines because he kind of criticized everyone for being there and talking about charity, and they turned up in private jets. I think it was the bin men of New York went on strike, and basically they wanted extra pay and better conditions, and the city lasted 2 weeks before it crumbled and gave them what they wanted. And then historically in Ireland, some bankers went on strike, and they were on strike for over a year, and then they ended up just going back to work because everyone just kind of found alternatives. So I think I'm really sort of, it's important to kind of sit back and look at that as an example of, the value is not always where you think it is in a business. You know, it'd be great. You can write all the business you like, but if no one's on credit control getting the money in the door, and then the business crumbles, for example,
Exactly that. And I think this is something we talk a lot about at HX, is to see HX as a system. Yeah, and not to optimize. You have to have very critical goals for individuals in that system, but your overall goal is to optimize the system, not the individuals.
Yeah. I was going to ask you about investment, because you obviously started the business with a bit with some investment. Why did you take that specific decision? What were there alternatives? Could you have potentially bootstrapped it? And what made you kind of go down that path?
It's a really good question. So, yeah, we did take some investment from trade investors, so insurance companies and senior professionals in the insurance market. Two parts to that. So could we have bootstrapped it? Possibly, actually. If I look with perfect hindsight through our financials and the really great start that we've had as a business, yeah, I think it's entirely possible that we could have bootstrapped it. I think the biggest thing for us is, you know, you want to have people who are whose interests are aligned with yours. And our goal has always been to build a really, really great product. And therefore, having investors, you know, whether they be venture-backed or trade investors, gives you accountability, yeah, to growing and building a really, really great product. Because those two things go absolutely hand in hand. I don't really necessarily subscribe to this idea that, you know, only venture investors can help you grow and only trade investors can help you build a really great product. I think those things are much more closely related. So yeah, to answer your question, could we have bootstrapped it? Possibly. Is it really useful to have a group of people in the market who to whom you're accountable, a group of people who are credible and respected, particularly in our own industry, which is still, you know, whenever we take HX to market and we've got a potential client who's interested, who's using it? Yeah, you know, that's the first question that gets asked. You know, not what's the feature set, what can it do? You know, give me some examples of deliveries. Like, just give me the name of who's using it, right? And for us, you know, getting off the ground, you know, in an industry that, you know, where we're the smallest by probably an order of magnitude and the newest by probably a decade or close to that, having some a vote of confidence, you know, from some individuals and corporation that are in the market was really, really useful for us. And the other thing is time horizon, right? Investment allows you to plan over a longer time horizon. And, you know, we didn't take a large investment round. You know, by most people's standards, it would, you know, this day and age, it's a, you know, a fraction of what would be taken as a seed round. But that allowed us to focus on building a good product. And, you know, our goal is to be here in the long term. Yeah, our goal is to be compoundingly adding value to our clients every year. And you can't do that if you can only build over, you know, to win that next sale or to, you know, to add that feature to make just, you know, the first client you've got happy. Difficult trade-off. I'm not suggesting that you can't bootstrap your way to it. Finding the right amount of investment at any one time is one of the number one challenges for a CEO kind of co-founder to have. You know, for us, it was about planning, credibility, and focus, I think, were the key things.
I'm sort of ambivalent about it. I think bootstrapping is great. It's something that I've really pushed, and I'd be full of it if I didn't say that, because I've said it on the podcast before. But within sensible limits, I think if you're building a piece of software, if you're building something that is, you want to be proactively innovating that software, and you don't want to be waiting hand and mouth for it. But there's a balancing act between taking too much, because it's the most expensive equity you ever give away, if you ever give it away, taking too little, that you've given away the equity but you haven't taken enough money to get to where you want to go. Absolutely. But I do like this idea as well. I mean, one of my friends has launched a very successful fintech, and he said one of the most important things for him was hiring people, because he was on his own for a long time. And he said, now I've got people that I'm responsible to. And it was that funny thing of, he was the boss, but he felt responsible to them because, you know, he'd hired them in.
And absolutely. You're absolutely right. I think, you know, the most common myth, I think, of being a CEO or a founding CEO, founder-led CEO of a founder-led company is that everyone works for you. Yeah, when you run a business, that's absolutely not true. I work for everyone, right? By definition, you know, in that it's my job to fill the gaps in any area. But also, these people have come into a business that, you know, I mean, we are a profitable, growing concern business now. But at the very beginning, when HX wasn't, you know, I make the wrong strategic decisions, and these people they lose their livelihoods. And these are smart, top tier people, right? The people who could be working at Google or Facebook, you know, helping out. Some of our team are, you know, doing things on the cutting edge of what's possible in technology. That's a strong motivator. Yeah, you've got to keep them employed. That's not a challenge for us anymore, but it certainly focuses the mind.
Yeah. So what's the journey been like? You have been very successful. And actually, we've got a mutual friend of the podcast, who I'll say off air, but he said, instead, you guys have done incredibly well, and it's been a sort of a great journey. What do you think's been behind that? Is it specifically the product, and how do you sort of keep that momentum?
Yeah, good questions. I'm going to be very honest with you. It's definitely, it's the product through and through. It's definitely not, you know, spectacular business acumen from me or the co-founders, because we are actuaries through and through. And, you know, I think we've only succeeded because we are focused on solving, and we are laser focused on this, and we always will be, certainly while I'm at the helm, on solving the very, very real, unsolved, or poorly solved in the market, you know, and we're at the beginning. We've not solved it perfectly yet either. Problem of helping our clients make better decisions with data. That's what we do. We haven't pivoted. We haven't changed what we do. We've been building, you know, fast, but thoughtfully and, you know, single-mindedly or focused towards solving this problem. And when people look at our product, you know, it's the one that best solves this problem for our clients. And that's how we have, we've occasionally won deals that have been, you know, sufficiently big where both parties have been scratching their heads as to how we ended up winning the deal and they ended up choosing, you know, choosing us. And it's because our product solves the problem that our competitors don't. And that's how I think we've succeeded so far. I think for us, growth now is going to be building around the kernel of that product and building the right processes to allow us to service many more clients. Mm-hmm. We don't have a sales team at HX. Yeah, we're a whatever it is, 20-person company with, you know, a very, very, very good revenue base that's growing very fast, and we have no sales team. Is mm-hmm. one example.
You're going to be the UK's Atlassian. Never.
I know. I read a lot about Atlassian. I think I naively, at the beginning, I liked the idea of not having a sales team because I'm an actuary and I never really understood sales. And now I understand sales a lot better because what I realized is that if you don't have a sales team, I have to do it.
Yeah, exactly.
and that's terrible for all parties involved. You know, Atlassian a fascinating case study. The factors going into that, the market timing, their sales strategy that they've set up, the individual developer orientation that they had, fascinating recipe. We will have a sales team at some point. But, you know, I think what we're doing now, you know, to build on our success is just to put the processes in place that a scale-up business, you know, needs. But we've absolutely succeeded entirely due to being a product that solves our clients' needs. And, you know, we are one of our clients. The ultimate compliment I think I got from Ben is that you argue a lot with us, but you deliver what you say you're going to do. So, you know, why have we succeeded? We tell the truth, not what our clients want to hear. Sometimes we don't win deals because of that.
Yeah.
That's been hard for us. Yeah, actually, because I've definitely been cases where I know that if I didn't tell the truth or I flexed the parameters as the actuary so that I could say, give them a client a different answer, then, you know, we'd probably win more. We actually really focus on our clients' needs. And actually we plan over a long time horizon. So, you know, we're building towards something that's going to be much more valuable next year than it is, you know, order of magnitude more valuable next year than it is this year. And that same thing applies to the way HX was this year versus last year versus the year before. And we can demonstrate that to our clients. But yeah, definitely nothing to do with me. Mainly my amazing team who've built an absolutely fantastic product that we're really, really proud of.
Yeah, I'm sure you're too modest, but I do understand that as well. And I feel your pain on the telling the truth. I pitched for a piece of work the other day, which I'm pretty sure I haven't won. And it was simply because I was asked about the time horizons. And I said how long I thought it would take. And I was told, oh, the other company rang, so it'll take half the time. And I had to very bluntly, in my very subtle Essex manner, go, well, then they don't know what they're talking about.
Completely.
You know, it was just 15 years of experience going, well, this will take X amount of time. And I appreciate that someone, you can buy what you want to hear or you can buy the truth. And I'd rather sit the truth and over time be justified as correct. I'm a big believer in that. I'm conscious of time. So I wanted to get to this slightly spicy question that we sort of talked about. You work in a tech company, specialty market, lots of talk about modernization, innovation. Everyone loves a bit of talking about blueprint to all this sort of stuff. Lots of innovation talk. why are we seeing so little action?
Yeah, it's a good question. It's the one that I reflect on a huge amount. So the way I would say this is I think there's loads of action in a small pocket, a small area. I think, you know, you look at the class of 2020, you look at the new players in the market, you know, the likes of Convex, a very dear client of ours, no legacy. By definition, yeah, they're starting with a blank slate. And I think this is something that it can't be oversold, is that someone who doesn't have any legacy, A, is starting with modern technology now, and B, doesn't have the weight of legacy technology around the next. It's a really highly leveraged thing.
Yeah.
But I think it's been incredibly difficult for incumbents to move away from the really organically grown, very fragmented mix of proprietary and open technology, lack of kind of technology operating model, into the horizon, kind of look at the horizon where we are now, right? Horizon and where we are now. So I think you've got people who are modern insurers without a legacy doing really, really innovative things. You know, they're almost frustrated themselves at where they are. And I look at what they've done. I'm like, you're really okay. It's not perfect, but yeah, you should see what some of your friends are doing.
Yeah.
That's one side. The other thing I would say is, you know, most insurance companies set up even 10 years ago, technology was almost, it was part of the operations team, or it was a operational adjunct to the core business.
Yeah.
That's not the case now. Yeah. Most companies in some way, shape or form, you know, are double digit percentage of their value, yeah, is technology. And at the very top level, they see that and they structure themselves as such. And it's not a service, you know, it's a core. And that's really hard to pivot. It's really hard to pivot, you know, to have the board, the top tier, you know, who many of the board members won't necessarily be tech centric, you know, in these companies. Because if you think of the average lifetime of these companies, you know, people who have been there, they're, you know, 30, 40 years, some of these board members, you know, that's a mindset that's not going to happen. It's like, that's just not going to change. Yeah. So I think we're going to see lots and lots of this talk. And I think people coming to market now with an imperative to be, you know, much more modern and technological, they will be. And they will set themselves up organizationally to be more tech-centric, and they won't have legacy. And that leverage is, you know, without exaggeration, it's 10x minimum. You know, I don't know how much of the budget of the, you know, more traditional incumbents is spent. The budget and headspace is spent on old tech and keeping the lights on, you know. Yeah. And by definition, it's zero. Yeah, at some of these companies. So that leverage is massive. It's massive. So, you know, I think what I would say there is it is going to change, but it's going to come in, it's going to be very, very skewed. It's going to be, to use that phrase used in investment, a kind of barbell investment strategy, right? Where you've got some companies that are doing it all in, and then the rest of them are unfortunately all out, or almost all out. But it's going to be hard for modern companies to change.
Yeah.
Older companies to change.
I have a lot of empathy for them, but I do think a lot of it sits with, yeah, everything's about mindset and culture, and I think that's really challenging. You've got, exactly as you say, you've got 30, 40 years serving board members, but you've also got, if you're an incumbent business, which has got loads of these legacy sort of platforms, monolithic platforms, prop software that doesn't integrate and talk to each other, but if you're the CTO of that business, for example, and your whole business has been maintaining those systems, and that's why you're paid the big bucks to sit there, you won't necessarily want to go down a path of this new software that you potentially don't understand, that you're not skilled for, or make some of this redundant, and there's a lot to do with that, about fiefdoms, and insurance is not unique in that, and technology is not unique in that. You see that within kind of underwriting, you know, why choose particular product lines, and it will be someone's biases towards that, or looking at it a certain way. I mean, at the moment, loads of people are diving into kind of, you know, North American D&O that don't have a legacy, and they're like, well, we haven't got any legacy losses, so we're going to go diving into that. And I question the logic on that, right? But really what I'm speaking to is just that it's fiefdoms and culture, and until some of these businesses, sadly, they're not going to make any moves until they evolve out their existing leadership structure to something more progressive.
Yeah, I think it's a really good analogy, a really interesting analogy. I haven't thought about that much myself, but I will do now, about the difference between people, you know, who take on modern classes which are unproven, yeah, and the mindset required to do that, versus just writing a lot more, you know, like your DNF property or whatever it is, whatever, where the markets are surging. Yeah, and I think, I suppose my point about the organizational structure is maybe it mirrors that point about culture. My experience has been that, you know, you've got CTOs or CIOs or heads of IT that want to do more, but they're very weighed down by the legacy. But you're absolutely right. Fiefdoms are, you know, they're very common. They're very common in our industry, in our market. Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how it plays out. You know, I think you're going to see you're going to see a very different way, or at least from based on our discussions with our clients and the way they want to go about their business. They want to trade differently.
Yeah.
They actually want to trade differently. And I think it's going to be really interesting to see how, you know, in the next year or so, you know, we want to play a part in this. If our clients, when they're trading, you know, if you're a broker and you bring a risk to market, yeah, and you trade with a modern insurer and you trade with a traditional insurer, I wonder how much of that will cause a real change. Because actually, I think that will be the point at which the tide really goes out of some of the incumbents, when actually they're like, well, cool, here's my spreadsheet. I'll just throw it over to you like I used to. Yeah. And then you've got someone else who's like, just click that link, you know, and you'll get a dashboard and it'll be ready, you know, and it's wired, hardwired directly into our system. So write a comment or whatever you need. Yeah. And we'll see it straight away. And, you know, we make some changes, we make the decisions, and my centralized model is free updated. That will be interesting.
Yeah, because there's a lot of things on that. I mean, I think we forget about customers, particularly in B2B sectors. There's in insurance, there's a lot less focus on, you know, the broker as a customer, you know, for example. Until you kind of focus on that and kind of give people those, until there's a, as you say, until there's a massive differentiator, and then you sort of start to say, well, why would I go and deal with this kind of spreadsheet when I can get this kind of slick interface that does a lot of work for me? Until you kind of make it, people have got to pay, right? It's got to be a pain point for them. It's got to be a pain point until it gets to be a pain point. If they continue to be successful as running legacy systems and legacy processes, then there's not an incentive to change. And actually, you can even say from a sort of leadership standpoint, that is also justifiable. You know, if you're making lots of money, a good profit without changing, why do it?
Completely. It's a legitimate strategy, right? And I think you're seeing a really interesting point in the market right now, where there are people we talk to. They're like, look, I've got spreadsheets. I'm happy with them. Mm. Yeah. I've got spreadsheets and databases. Yeah. It's no problem. It's what we do. We've done it for 20 years. And what's the cost versus what's the benefit? I think, it's going to be interesting when we see what the insurers can do in 5 years. Well, not even 5 years, in 2 or 3 years, the insurers that are coming to market now. Because when I look at what they want to do and our part that we have to play, I'm very, very excited about, you know, I speak candidly about just how much easier their lives are going to be.
Yeah.
You know, having been the actuary, you know, having been variously been the analyst, data monkey, all the way up to decision maker, having to deal with the consequences of systems that, like, you know, spreadsheets and databases, the old school ones, you know, and the time and cost and effort and, you know, inertia and all of those things. It's going to be interesting to see, you know, when the difference in how they feel now, you know, why would I bother with it, how they'll feel in 2 or 3 years if the market does it right, if they, you know, if these new innovators come and do it. And we've got a long way to go. We all have a long way to go to realize that vision.
Yeah. No, I knew I shouldn't have opened that can of worms right at the end, but I'm glad.
Sorry.
I'm glad we got to talk about it. I mean, it reflects on, you know, if I look at my role in terms of senior hires, it used to be underwriting broken claims almost exclusively, and then over time it became more operations, and it's slightly more data focused, and now it's more data engineering, technology focused, and that's that's just reflective of the hires that are being made at senior level. So we are seeing that change. And as you rightly say, the more progressive insurers, the new ones to the market, are making much heavier investments in those sectors. So look, I'll leave it there because I've already pushed the hour boundary already. So that's a good reflection because I didn't notice it go. So Amrit, thank you very much for your time. I really, really do appreciate it.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me. I enjoyed that.
Yeah, no, not at all. And what was the name of your podcast again so people can go and check it out?
Yep, Startup Dads. Come and check out the Hyper Exponential LinkedIn page or my LinkedIn page. You'll see lots of promotion there.
And I will make sure that I include a link in the below.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, sir.
You're very welcome. Thanks.
Bye.
So there you go. That was Amrit from HX. What a great guy. I really enjoyed that. I feel like I'm boring and I say that I always enjoy that, but I really, really do. So I started this podcast because it comes out of my business interest, but it is out of my interests. And you get to meet some interesting people. And Amrit was certainly one of those. So thank you, Amrit, for your time and insight. I really enjoyed it. As ever, this show was brought to you by FinPro. We are finpro.com is the website if you want to find out more about what we do. We're a specialist a recruitment firm that operates in the insurtech and insurance space. I've been your host, Alex Bond. If you want to reach out to me directly with some feedback, good or bad, or if you'd be interested in potentially being a guest on the show, please let me know. You can contact me on LinkedIn, so that's Alex Bond at FinPro, or feel free to reach out to me on email, which is alex@wearefinpro.com. I look forward to speaking to more of you guys soon, and reach out to me if you want to find out more.